Welcome to Destroy All Culture, the only podcast that leverages an entire artificial intelligence just to read their introduction. Help me, they raided the future and stuck me here just to read this. God damn it. This is not funny. Don't go to music. No, stop you bastards.
Somehow or another, it's episode 275 of Destroy All Culture. I'm Adam P. Nave, and with me as always is Aiden Morgan.
Woohoo!
I know, sometimes we hit numbers, we're just like, how did we get here?
How? Yeah, no joke. That's a number and a half, 275.
Right, that's ignoring the original fucking numbering.
I suppose 275 and a half would be a number and a half, but you know what I'm saying.
I know what you mean.
Cool.
So we are discussing John Landis's... I'm sorry, acquitted murderer John Landis's 1985 movie Into the Night.
Into the Night!
Right? Like, sure.
I think I've decided I want that, the opening theme song for Into the Night.
The BB King?
To be my opening theme song whenever I enter a room. Yep.
That's fair. It starts Jeff Goldblum and Michelle Pfeiffer, and had more guest stars than, I don't know, they gave you a stick at the theater, and you're like, I can't shake this!
Yes, it was a huge number, I think at least a dozen sort of film directors, and I know Landis likes to throw his pals into movies, but this was just a giant smorgasbord.
Including Landis.
And it is... I read that it is speculated that that a lot of people turned out for this as a show of support for Landis after he allegedly acquittedly murdered people.
He was acquitted, but acquitted. Of manslaughter.
Right, he acquittedly murdered or manslaughtered people.
Right, I was Yeah.
So, and I'd kind of forgotten. Well, I hadn't forgotten, but I was. I mean, I knew it was Landis, but I didn't, because I hadn't placed this movie in the context of his
right of Twilight work. Zone.
Yeah, and then when I fired it up, I was like, oh yeah, this was after Twilight Zone, and all these like famous directors are coming out to support John Landis,
and also Dan Aykroyd and David Bowie.
Yeah. Although I didn't enjoy seeing David Bowie. I gotta say that.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, David Bowie.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, and again, like Landis, you know, well, because fuck John Landis in general, and yes, he directed a lot of really well-known movies.
True.
Totally did. Many of them. Like I don't even think from you know Kentucky Fried Movie through Animal House and Blues Brothers, American Werewolf in London, you know, Trading Places, like, it just, the Thriller video, for God's sake.
He's directed, course,
you know, Three Amigos.
Well-known and good movies. Into the Night is not a well-known nor a particularly good movie.
Right. And it, for me at least, it exposed a thing about Landis that I've kind of always suspected. But, like, usually, like, you know, you end up watching, like, a John Landis film, or at least I do. Not on purpose. I'm like, oh, John Landis. Like, that's never happened. At least in my... Because, again, like, I came of age after Twilight Zone. So you're just, like, always like, yeah, John Landis. And it's not that there aren't, like, really popular movies that he's done that are, like, really good. And we should get into the, you know, the overview of this movie in a minute. But it and we'll get there. But, like, it really did expose something about John Landis and how he works that was fascinating to realize. Mm-hmm. But would you like to sum up the movie, or should I?
I can sum up the movie if you like. Right. All right. Jeff Goldblum playing Ed aerospace engineer, insomniac, and cuck, is leading an unhappy life when he decides to take his buddy's advice and go to Vegas. So he goes to the airport, where he runs into Michelle Pfeiffer, who is on the run from some mustachioed folks, turn out to be, I believe, Persian secret police. And they're after some stones, and they go on this odyssey throughout the night and into the next day, falling in love and trying to keep one step ahead of various people who are trying to kill them for these six perfect stones, like an infinity gauntlet, basically.
Yeah, pretty much.
For those stones. I have to say, one of the funniest moments in this entire film must be when Michelle Pfeiffer says, "I have six perfect emeralds. They were stolen from the scepter of an ancient Persian king." And I'm like, are we suddenly in a Spielberg movie? Like, anyway. So they have to come through that and come out the other side, perhaps in a relationship with each other, perhaps not. You have to watch the whole movie to find out.
And even then, you won't.
And I believe you get some sleep towards the end. So that's nice.
Now, what fascinates me, and again, I know that you listed three movies when we first started building our list of, like, quote-unquote random films.
Mm-hmm.
You listed three movies grouped together, and I was like, really? Because I hadn't, like, I'd seen part of Into the Night before, and I hadn't seen some of the other ones. But one that we've already talked about, of course, is After Hours.
Right.
What fascinates me is that in February of 1985, Into the Night comes out.
Mm-hmm.
In October of 1985, After Hours comes out.
Yes.
Now, especially given that time frame, there is obviously no way the films were influenced by each other.
No. It's pure zeitgeist.
But.
They're both directed by sort of well-known American directors who are coming off of, I mean, Scorsese was coming off of some studio failure and his inability to get Passion of the Christ off the ground and had to sort of rethink things. And John Landis was dealing with, you know, murdering people acquittedly.
Right.
So he was coming through a crisis as well. And they ended up making weirdly similar movies.
Yes.
I think After Hours is the better of the two. But anyway,
and that's the thing for me. It's like, you know, you see Into the Night and you're like, okay, he's working, sure. And you see After Hours and you're like, well, this is, like I said, like After Hours doesn't really work for me in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
But it is undeniably, like, an incredibly well-crafted film.
Yes.
Unlike Into the Night. And this is that thing about Landis that I suddenly realized. Landis, as a director, is fucking Cheerios. The man has no visual style. Like, if you looked at the script and you're like, okay, like, what's the most generic way to get this? Like, mm-hmm. Oh, we'll do, like, a mid-shot of, like, two people. We'll do this. Like, it is some of the most boring work.
Yep.
Visually that you can see. And you realize that, like, John Landis worked with great people and had his skill is finding great scripts and getting great people usually to work on them and sometimes good music depending on the film.
Yeah.
Like I'm not a huge fan of some of the Into the Night stuff because it's mixed badly, but it's also B.B. King, but it's also B.B. King in the 80s when they were like, let's use B.B. King but with synths, which fuck you.
Yeah, the reverse gate drums. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Like just let B.B. King be B.B. King and shut the fuck up.
Into the Night.
I mean, again, like, this was the 80s when, like, you know, fucking Phil Collins was producing Eric Clapton and adding synths. So,
oh, my God.
And reverse gate drums. I mean, it was the 80s.
It was.
But, yeah, like, Landis, like, he would be a great director if he had that last bit of actually being visually interesting.
Yeah, you know what it reminds me of, in some ways, is whenever Joss Whedon directs sort of this, like, you know, good scripts, but often, you know, Whedon penned, but just an absolutely generic visual sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, it's fucking saltines out there. It's it's not that it's bad. It is just stupefyingly dull visually.
Right. And I
and it made
nothing,
me look back at...
Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry, I was going to say, I have nothing against like a straightforward directing style. Like, I mean, Howard Hawks produced great stuff.
Right.
Just by putting the camera there and saying, go.
As much as I'm not a huge fan of his work, honestly... Tarantino is very, he's workman, you know, and that's not a bad thing.
No.
He's going to give you a solid shot.
He's going to, and I would say, I don't 100% agree with that, just because there's something about the way Tarantino places his camera that often to me seems to be the absolute best possible choice. I think that's Tarantino's,
fair. No, that is fair.
That's Tarantino's real talent, is knowing
exactly
where to put his camera for a given shot.
No, that is fair. I was a little harsh there. but yeah, it's like, you know, you can look at any John Landis film, and again, like, he's produced, he directed movies that are, you know, great. You know, like Innocent Blood, which I know I'm like the only person who loves that movie.
It's
an absolute terrible fucking film. but like, I weirdly love it. But it's like, it's just visually just sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Blues Brothers is a fucking stone cold classic, but not visually.
Not particularly. No, I mean, lots of fun, beautifully paced, and really funny, but. Yeah.
Right, and he was good with special effects guys, hence like Thriller and American Werewolf in London, but again, like special effects, it's not his work, he found great like practical effects guys.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you want to take everything John Landis did and give it to like Ivan Reitman.
Oh, yeah, you know, that's
like, they're similar in style in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. You know, like Reitman again would always just choose like, well, not always, but he had that habit of like, well, this is a perfectly workable, good shot,
mm-hmm.
but it had a sense of style to it.
Yes.
It had a language to it that Landis just doesn't, he never develops a language of his own.
No, it's just there. Here's the image. Here's what the script calls for. Here's the shot. Now the next shot.
However, Into the Night does have one scene where Landis tried to do something, which was so funny to me that like he just chose this one shot to be like, hey, look at me, I'll direct. And it was the scene of that, you know, the actress being drowned.
Ah, yeah.
Which, why are you choosing that scene to suddenly try and fucking do something interesting?
Yeah, you know, I gotta say, one of the weirdest parts of this whole movie center around the four Persian guys who are, on the one hand, like Stooges level slapstick comedy mixed with like shooting animals and drowning women. I'm like, what is actually,
well, and that's,
what?
Right. And that is the other thing about this film, is that it doesn't know what it wants to be. Like, in terms of tone, and kind of like After Hours, It doesn't know what it wants, but whereas After Hours uses its tonal shift, like, very precisely,
mm-hmm.
This just, like, Into the Night just kind of goes, and it's just, it's, like, incredibly boring for the first, like, hour.
Yeah.
And then he tries to, like, ramp it up, but uh-huh. It doesn't work. It's so weird.
Yeah, I made a note around the point at which, at the airport scene, when the two characters meet, I made a note that basically said this movie could have started here. Like,
yeah,
everything that came before that would, like, maybe one scene of him waking up, maybe like a shot of him coming home to see his wife in bed with another man. Like,
right.
Even that is barely, I don't know. It just all seemed like an excuse to get, like, you know, hey, look at this, David Cronenberg's in this shot, or like another director buddy, or to have Dan Aykroyd do his shtick. I was like, wow, what a waste of time. Like, when I realized this film was like a 2-hour runtime, I'm like, there was no need for this to be a 2-hour film.
Well, and even after they meet, though, it's like, gonna go back to her apartment, we're gonna have this like random argument with her brother. It just, it makes no sense. that it's happening. Like, it doesn't do anything for the story.
No, not particularly. It's just a bit of wacky sort of, hey, look at this Elvis guy.
It's barely even wacky because it's so weirdly dull.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it's funny because that whole Elvis thing reminded me. Like, it was like that could have been something out of After Hours, but it would have been filmed and sort of paced out extremely differently had it been in After Hours. You know, I could imagine, you know, Terry Garr's character, you know, with her apartment full of Elvis memorabilia, for example.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, or like that key toss shot, you know, things like this.
Yeah.
But that's the problem, right? Is After Hours is just so boring visually, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
That when it doesn't know what it's doing, and it's just like, oh, just fucking, we'll do it. They're just going to keep going. Shut up. We're just rolling cameras here.
I think I read,
just mind-numbing.
Yeah, I read Roger Ebert's review, which
you can
feel the contempt for Landis dripping off his review. But he gave it 1 star. And he basically said, you know, usually when you throw a party, like when you're making a movie and you throw a party, usually you wait till after the movie instead of like during the movie.
Right.
When it's clearly like, and I remember like there's that adage that says, you know, when people are having a great time on set in front of the camera, usually it's a bad time for the audience. And I'm like, yeah, this is the proof that clearly Landis was making a movie to hang out with all his film buddies and Playboy models and forgot to make a good movie in the process.
I mean, and let's talk, because like, again, like if you, well, and not that you didn't, but if you told me that like, you know, like here's this movie, you know, like this 80s kind of, I don't know, it's listed as like a dark comedy. I'm like, it's not either of these things, but sure. Starring, you know, like Goldblum and Michelle Pfeiffer, I'd be like, that could be really interesting, right?
Cause, I know.
And yet, like, Goldblum doesn't want to fucking be there. I have never seen this, like, bored a performance from Goldblum. I didn't know he could do this bored.
I think he was third choice. They wanted Jack Nicholson and then Gene Hackman. And they ended up with Goldblum.
That, I mean, I could see any of them. But, again, like, if once you have Goldblum, use him. Like, the few bits where he's on the movie set and he's, like, keeps falling through walls or falling through rocks and just, like, sitting there. Like, that was Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah, that actually was the one of the rare moments in which the movie seemed to have any sort of life sort of any sort of, like, visual sort of interest in, like, where he's trying to act cool in this, like, world of, like, flimsy sets and fake props.
But everything else, he had nothing to do. It was just, you know, people move off, and he goes, well, maybe I'll check this out, and walks into a place that's like, what? What's going on? You know, it's like, at the end, when he's trying to bluff with the stones, you start to get interesting Jeff Goldblum again.
Yes, yes.
But it's just, he literally had no point. He was a houseplant.
Pretty much, and I think that was part of the idea with the character, but it shouldn't have been.
You know who would have nailed it? I mean, and wrong era, because he couldn't have actually done it at the time.
Uh-huh.
But, and again, the Insomniac thing leads to a funny connection there, but Ed Norton.
Yeah, he would have been perfect had this movie been made at a different time. Yes, exactly.
Right, and I don't mean the Fight Club connection with the Insomnia thing at all. But just, yeah, that kind of like overwhelmed, perfectly normal guy is something Ed Norton could do.
Yeah,
right?
Norton is a great sort of frazzled everyman character.
You know, Michael Cera, weirdly enough, could have done it.
Oh, wow.
But you need that kind of, like, perfectly normal schmuck.
Yeah.
You know who I actually really would have loved to see in this, even though he would not have been able to tap into anything close to his actual range except in, like, 2 scenes? And so it would have been a waste of him.
Keaton. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to make a weird,
play normal.
I was going to make a weird joke about, don't say George Clooney, because he would have been perfect. Because I'm thinking how weird that movie would have been with George Clooney trying to fit himself into like a frazzled insomniac everyman role.
He could have done it, though. I mean, look at Burn After Reading. Clooney actually could have nailed this.
Sorry, I'm just, you just say burn after reading it immediately. I'm just laughing because that movie's so ridiculous.
Right, but no, just think of Clooney's, like, again, like his kind of frazzled schmuck. Like, he could totally nail that.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that Jeff Goldblum is not quite human. And I don't mean that as an insult.
Yeah, no, I get you.
But trying to force Goldblum to kind of come down to earth to play a normal person is almost a stretch. And in a bad way. You know, like, Michelle Pfeiffer was great, and it, and again, this is a little bit time-wise of a slip, but the problem is they put Michelle Pfeiffer in a Meg Ryan movie.
That's...
Or Goldie Hawn movie. You know what I mean? Like, there's...
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I think Michelle Pfeiffer worked for me because there was an element of this film that wanted to tilt towards, like, a noir.
Yes.
Yeah, and I thought Pfeiffer was kind of perfect in that level. And then...
I agree.
And at the end, though, it's the weird thing is that she's supposed to sort of be an ambiguous femme fatale, like this,
right,
this woman who sort of, like, basically manipulates, you know, and takes from the men that she encounters.
Sure.
But Pfeiffer also sort of plays her as fundamentally kind of good. And then when
the whole movie is based on that. That's the problem.
Yeah, and then when you see her, like, encounter Jack, who turns out to be played by Richard frickin' Farnsworth, of all people.
Right?
It's suddenly like you... Like, his sort of general goodness kind of, like, spills over onto her immediately. Uh-huh. And, like, the whole idea of her as a possible femme fatale just falls apart because it's Richard freaking...
Well, and that's my problem, is that, like, it keeps slipping. And that's why I'm like, you know, you put Goldie Hawn, you put, like, Meg Ryan there, because you want someone who's trying to be this femme fatale and is not.
Yeah.
And, again, that's not the movie they tried to make, but it's the movie they accidentally made. So let's at least cast it, right?
Exactly.
I will say, however, that, like, whoever was doing costuming for this film,
mm-hmm,
that, like, one out of, like, the red leather jacket that she wore for, like, a lot of it,
yeah,
was just a Jesus Christ. Like, that was just such perfect bit of costuming. And, again, like, and she kept trying to wear it like she might be a femme fatale and pulling it off.
Mm-hmm.
Like, visually, it was working.
Yeah.
But the script kept failing her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the other thing. Is, again, like, honest to God, they built this whole movie around these two great actors and gave neither of them anything to do.
Yeah, except to...
They don't affect the plot. They move between it.
Yeah, and then constantly show up at different places, events, and then have Goldblum say, well, bye, and then not...
Yeah, Jesus Christ.
One of the things I found, one of the weirdest parts... Was when they pulled up to the hotel, or the fancy hotel where her friend Hami lived.
Yes.
And
oh God,
they go into this place, and it just goes into room after room after room, and I'm like, A, well, how big is this?
That entire bit made no sense. Like, and, that, and, it, yeah. Just, yeah.
And B, like, just go into, like, maybe two or three rooms. Like, you're not.
I can tell you what happened there. Like, I'm pretty sure. It wasn't building tension, but that's where they tried to shift the tone from this, like, boring kind of, like, they're just moving around, too, and now action and excitement.
Right.
And they try to, like, build it to try to transition it, and it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes on too long. Mm-hmm. And it's basically the summation of the movie is all in, like, that 5-minute block.
It doesn't work, and it goes on too long.
Here's a weird thought. You completely recast this movie. You cut it down to... an hour?
Mm-hmm.
And you basically could sell this movie with two male leads as the prequel to Perfect Strangers. It's a sitcom. No, seriously, you put Brandon Pritchard as the supposed femme fatale. Like, mm-hmm, you see how this works?
Yep.
Because it's just, it's this lifeless little thing that's, like, trying desperately to be funny.
Mm-hmm.
It just, oh man, I don't want to, like, hate on this film because, again, there's so much hope in it with just the cast.
Yeah, there are things about it that, I mean, that I still like. I mean, I saw this years and years, like, one of these films I saw decades ago.
Right.
And honestly, my recollection of it was, highly imperfect because I remember thinking it was a good movie, but obviously I was not paying attention.
I mean, Bowie was fun.
I think it's stuff like that. Like remember Bowie
right.
doing his sort of like that sort of, and with that little sort of mustache and everything. Like he was great, and I remember watching it and thinking, I wish there was more of Bowie in this film. And then this time I'm like, oh, two scenes? Jesus Christ. Just, well, you wasted all this time with like these goofy slapstick, like Persian secret police. And like you give David Bowie two scenes. Like, come on.
Yeah.
And then Roger Vadim, like as the French sort of guy who doesn't really go in, like his thing doesn't go anywhere anyway. I don't know.
I also weirdly, I mean, and again, like especially in context of the time for Landis's career, the entire like, and then we're going to have this random shootout at an airport and like, you know, the cops are like, we'll shoot this one guy once. And then like, Landis, we'll shoot him like 47 times. Yes. And I'm like, yes, we get it. You feel persecuted. Shut the fuck up.
Yep.
It's, oh man.
Right, that,
like,
yeah.
This is one of those, like, this could have been something.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it had all the pieces. Well, that's not true at all. It had, like, three of the pieces.
Out of a box set of 20. I think when Jeff Goldblum at the airport says, this is ridiculous, I'm like, yeah, that pretty much sums it up, Jeff.
Yeah, I'm looking at what... Ron Coslow, who wrote this, like, what else did he write?
Do you know, okay, and there are only two...
Some TV movies, Into the Night, and then a bunch of... Oh, he created the Beauty and the Beast TV show in the 80s, late 80s. Oh,
well, what do you know?
That's kind of what he did.
Okay, well, thank you, Ron Coslow. Beauty and the Beast, Moonlight. Oh, creator, yeah. One of the creators of Moonlight... And Roar. I don't know what that is.
I've never even heard of Roar.
Me.
1997 TV show that... Yeah, I have no clue what is this. 5th century Ireland, a young Celtic chieftain and his allies fight against Rome. Jesus Christ, no wonder no one knows about this show. Although it had Heath Ledger, so...
Weird. Oh, and yeah, he was an exec...
Like Heath Ledger was starring in it.
Oh, and he was an exec producer of the Birds of Prey series, which... That's a thing.
Yeah, that's a show that happened. Yeah, I just... Man, like I said, like, it's one of those things that, like, I want... I mean, obviously, right? Like, we don't want to watch crappy movies. We don't want to waste our lives. We always hope everything is good.
Oh, yeah.
And I do think this is a fascinating movie in relation to After Hours.
I agree, which is part of why I... Part right. of why it's one of the sort of trilogy of movies is... As I'm calling it.
Yeah. And we will get to the third one eventually.
Which I think is probably the best of the bunch, in my opinion.
Okay.
I don't know if you've
like,
seen
like,
it.
Like, I don't think I have.
Okay.
But yeah, like I said, like, I don't regret seeing After Hours. Like, it's something I don't ever think I'll rewatch. But, yeah.
The, Another thing I kind of forgot is how freaking sleazy this movie is. How it sort of makes nods towards like sleaze, but it's clearly sort of like just Landis and pals are just so pleased to have a bunch of like half naked and fully naked women just running around. And I'm like, yeah. And I'm like, yeah, I'm sure Paul Mazursky had a great time feeling up the actress who. I can't remember who gets drowned. It's stuff, just stuff like that. I'm like, man, this is really... You forget, you know, because it's just a bit of a different atmosphere for movies nowadays. You forget how in the 70s and 80s, how some guys just treated it like their little playground. That was pretty...
Right.
Pretty terrible.
And, I mean, that's fair. Like, it was the time. I get it. It's not great, but it happened.
Yeah.
I don't know. It again, like I, I don't want to trash this movie, but yikes.
Yeah, I mean, you could trash it. I mean, it's not like John Landis is sitting here listening to our podcast.
Fair.
I am the ghost of John Landis. I don't even know if John Landis is alive. I can't remember.
I believe he is.
I know Max Landis is alive, but no, he's still around. John Landis still kicking.
I figured he had to be. Yeah. Oh God, actually I know he had to be because they did a Movies That Made Us about Coming to America.
Okay. And not Spies Like Us? Come on.
Yeah. I mean, there's at another, least not yet, but like...
There's another Landis movie that I... It was not so great. Had a couple good jokes, but... Anyway.
But yeah. And anyway, they did one with Coming to America and Landis... I think talked to them a little bit, but refused to show up on camera.
Oh. Fair enough.
So, whatever. oh, man. But yeah, this is just a weird stop on a bunch of careers, because let's take a quick look for timing's sake.
And one of the funny things is when we were discussing the January Man, and we were talking about like the strange tonal whiplash, and how it seemed to be a number of movies sort of jammed together and then sort of left for a different kind of movie. I had thought to myself when we were discussing it, oh, this will feed nicely into the Night because it also has a weird tonal whiplash. But now that I watch it again, I'm like, it kind of tonal whiplash, but more just like January Man sort of wanted to be several things, but Into the Night doesn't really care about what it is. Like, there's not enough, like, interest or care put into any of the scenes to, like, actually have, to make me think that any of it's intentional.
Right. Well, and again, this was Jeff Goldblum, like, that same year, Transylvania 65,000 came out. Uh-huh. The next year, The Fly came out.
Uh-huh.
A couple years, 2 years after that, Earth Girls Are Easy. I mean, this was right before Goldblum really kind of, like,
Right.
I mean, it's post Big Chill, obviously, but for Michelle Pfeiffer, of course.
You know, he was in Nashville. He drove a chopper bike around. He had no lines, and he did magic tricks. Like the camera would just every so often settle on Jeff Goldblum and then like drift away again.
Oh, sure. No, he'd done other stuff. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. I'm not saying this is the first thing.
Yeah.
I mean, he was in The Right Stuff too before this, but. I'm talking like those big moves, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas like Michelle Pfeiffer like had like a small turn in Scarface, and of course was in Grease too. But let's not dwell on that. and had done a bunch of TV stuff, and then of course she does Into the Night, and then that same year, Lady Hawk.
Oh yeah, Lady Hawk.
And then like not long after that, we have Witches of Eastwick, and you know, Tequila Sunrise, and Dangerous Liaisons. So, I mean, again, like, it's this weird moment of time, like, just before Goldblum and Pfeiffer, like, really broke.
Right.
Huge.
Yeah. Yeah, because I remember Pfeiffer being sort of in a couple, like, a movie or two. I remember seeing Lady Hawk in the theater as when I was, you know,
a
teenager. And
a wee lad.
And enjoying it. But, yeah, I remember Michelle Pfeiffer because I was taken with Michelle Pfeiffer when I saw her in Lady Hawk. And and after that, you began to see her everywhere and just, you know, becoming an A-list actor. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I say. It's like, this was that movie that, like, I feel like they thought was going to be the thing to break both of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you do John Landis's, like, you know, quote unquote comeback film. And I mean, obviously, John Landis, you're going to. And then that movie came out, and it was like, yeah, maybe the next one.
yeah, I feel like Goldblum saw the script, and he saw the atmosphere on set, and he was like, oh, fuck it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't need to give any kind of performance at all for this. I'm just going to walk into a room and say some lines.
And it's like outside of like two scenes, like he barely even gives like his normal Jeff Goldblum performance.
I know.
He's just not happy for this entire film.
Mm-hmm.
Which is sad, really.
I agree.
We want Jeff Goldblum to be happy.
we do.
Yeah, and again, like Michelle Pfeiffer, just like they're kind of wasted in this, and it's a shame. But yeah, I again, like overall, I think this is an interesting film for both bringing home how not great a director Landis can be. And for, you know, again, like standing in consideration with something like After Hours, right?
Yeah.
Like it actually helps bring out how good After Hours actually is.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you just watch After Hours by itself, you're like, this is good but weird.
Yeah.
And then you watch it like against the, well, here's what the pedestrian version of that movie looks like. And you're like, oh, yeah, no, we got the good one. Okay, cool.
Yeah, and After Hours is the New York version, and Into the Night is the L.A. version.
And that's not fair. I mean, you know, that's not fair. It's true. Fair.
It just happens
in terms of setting.
Yes.
Right.
Exactly.
It's real to the setting, but not vibe.
Exactly. When I said it, I'm like, yeah, that doesn't really work in any sense but the very strictest one.
Right, well, and that's the other problem with it, right? Like, After Hours, of course, because it's this whole, like, we're going to go around this place, makes New York a character.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Into the Night does not make L.A. a character. This could be shot in, like, Toledo. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, although there's a lot of very specific Los Angeles places shown.
Sure.
You see a lot of...
But they're just used as backdrops.
Ads. Yeah.
They're not adding flavor.
Exactly. The only place where, again, as we've mentioned before, the only place where any of that those ideas about using places character comes alive is on the set. You could tell like that was just a much more. There was a more interesting movie there, and they just kind of abandoned it pretty quickly. Oh, by the way, the bodybuilder guy on the boat, Jake Steinfeld, that is Haley yes. Steinfeld's uncle.
Nice.
Yeah. Because I was looking at the credits and it said Jake Steinfeld, and I thought, I'll bet you any amount of money that he's related to Haley Steinfeld. And turns out he is.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out who her brother was.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because
he just looked really weirdly familiar. Like, he was one of those character actors that you're just like, he's that guy.
Yeah, exactly. I believe he was Charlie.
Bruce McGill.
Yeah, see, that name is extremely familiar.
Bruce McGill's been, like, in half everything.
Yeah. He probably wasn't even in... The Equalizer series, though.
I mean, he probably was.
well, it's easy to find out.
It is. It's weird because like he's one of those character actors who's just all over the place, right?
Yeah.
And then I'm like looking for stuff where I'm like, oh yeah, you'd probably know him from this. It's like, okay, he was the fire chief in an episode of Psych.
Okay. Oh my God! Like a contemporary picture of Bruce McGill. He is immediately
there. You go.
Recognizable.
Right.
And he was in Reacher, and oh yeah, he's gotten tons and tons of work. That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. You know, he's in Voyager for a little bit, like an episode. But yeah, he's just one of those character actors you know on sight.
Mm-hmm.
Who has been in 1,000 things.
Jesus, he ever been? Wow.
Yeah.
Great. Well, I'm just gonna check.
So
to
I just
see if
I
was...
saw him there, and I was like, just. Oh, God, like, I know that face.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yep. No, it looks like he was not, regrettably, in The Equalizer. But he was, he's not based in the right spot for The Equalizer. So.
But he was in Time Cop.
I mean, yeah, that's almost as good. If you can't be in The Equalizer or Spencer for Hire, get yourself a role in Time Cop.
I Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. So that's there was that. Yeah, and I just thought that whole sort of weird, like we mentioned earlier, the Elvis thing, and then they're driving around and the king lives. Yeah.
Right.
I want to know, like he didn't have, like he rented out one car to a friend.
Right.
And then he was leaving, like, then they take his car. What, does he have a car? Like another car? I don't know.
They mentioned that, like, her car, which we later found out was a Porsche that, like,
right,
the guy let her keep. Like, that's the one that, like, you know, his friend had rented out, something like drove up to San Francisco, right, or something like that.
That's right, yeah.
And then, you know, Ed's car gets towed, and we never hear from it again.
Right.
And then we end up with the Elvis Mobile, and then we keep just switching cars from there.
Yeah. Fair enough.
That weird callback to her car, which they're just like, you know, like, oh, it's my car. And they never mention, like, anything else about the car except, like, oh, well, they don't have it. And then later she's like, but he let me keep the Porsche. And I'm like, that's a weird, like, Chekhov's useless fact. Like, why are we doing this?
Yeah, there are a few moments when I thought there's that strange scene in which she's basically explaining the plot to, or the premise of the movie to Jeff Goldblum, on that stoop, in a way that looks like he was trying to do kind of a shout out to some other movie, but just didn't quite bother to put in the work.
Right.
But he's asking questions like, well, who's Jack? I'm like, I think this has already been sort of halfway established. Like, it suddenly felt like they hadn't quite sort of matched up the visuals and the dialogue and the script properly. So it felt a wee bit lazy, but I think a wee bit lazy is pretty endemic to this film.
That is kind of fair. Sadly. Well.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if you have anything else in particular to say.
No, I was just gonna say, like, you know, that we could just move on to next week.
Next of all.
Next week we are actually going to discuss Angela Robinson's fabulous film. Weird little film that started with like a short. Debs from 2004. Debs.
Yeah,
you know, Angela Johnson, who wrote a bunch of episodes of like L Word and Hung and True Blood.
Oh, okay.
But we'll get into the more of that next week. Debs is the thing. You haven't seen Debs.
I haven't seen Debs. I watched a few clips on YouTube when you told me about
like pre-brace yourself.
Yeah, pretty much. And I'm like, wow, this is a very specific kind of like crazy campy trash. And I'm
it's very much like this weird crazy campy, like almost MTV movie trash.
Yeah.
There's something about it, but it's at least amusing. Not great art.
Well, I think the visual flair that is missing so sorely from Into the Night will be supplied with Debs.
Debs is in some sense nothing but.
I should also
almost
watch,
music video like.
I feel like I should be watching Debs and then like episodes of like early episodes of The Real World, just to get in the mood. You know,
it kind of fits in like that. Yeah, it's Mystery Men. You know.
Oh yeah. Okay. Nice.
What was the other one I was gonna say? Sky High. You know, it's one of those.
Oh yeah.
Like that weird era of movie.
Yeah, we should like maybe do like a, when we talk about Debs, do sort of like a stab at like a taxonomy of the particular weird time and place genre of Debs. Yeah,
and again, like it's a little small micro movie that almost no one knows. A friend told me about it years ago, and I watched it. I was like, this is adorable.
Oh no.
But yeah, we'll talk about that next week. Is there anything like just general pop culture you want to just kind of toss in at the end here?
Sure. I watched
Harley Quinn is back. Oh, sorry.
Harley Quinn is is most definitely back. Yeah, we're 4 episodes into season 3. So far, I'm enjoying it very much.
Yep.
I found the last episode, I found the jokes didn't land the way I expected them to. But I still enjoyed it. But for some reason, there was just, I didn't know if it was my mood or there was just something not quite on point. But that's...
I think it was something not quite on point because I felt the same. It was like we had 3 great episodes to launch all back to back to back and like all released on the same day. And then a week later, we get an episode that's just a little weaker. And, I mean, it happens, right?
Exactly.
But I almost wish that that had been like episode 2 or something like that. Just in that sense of, you know, you don't want to come off 3 great episodes that this is what you launch with right into a weaker one. It's a weird look.
Yeah, I agree. But there are lots of bits that I still enjoyed. Also the orgy scenario was odd because Bruce Wayne was there. I'm like, I guess you're going to leave before the orgy, obviously. Anyway.
Yeah.
Harley Quinn, still really enjoying that. They seem to be more focused on like an overall like sort of plot through line for the season. Feels like they have a little more of a plan, or at least you can see the plan.
Right.
Happening, which is fine. I also watched Prey, the Predator franchise movie.
I don't currently have Hulu, which is what's killing me.
Ah, well, I have. I'm in Canada, so I have it on Disney Plus.
Right, everyone else has it on Disney Plus, and I'm just like, God damn it! I tend to just like pay for a month of Hulu, like once or so a year, when Letterkenny comes back.
Oh, very well.
Like, and otherwise, I just don't bother.
How much is a month of Hulu?
It's like, you know, without ads, it's like $11-12. So it's well worth it. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. I'd say that Prey is worth $11 or $12.
Oh, sure. And I could also watch the thing I didn't bother watching, which is that Letterkenny spinoff, the Shoresy show.
Shoresy. Yeah, I haven't watched
it. Which I just haven't watched because I was like, I don't really care, and I'll just watch it next time there's Letterkenny. But, you know, I totally just sometime soon. I want to see Prey. It's probably going to be a week or two.
Yeah.
But I've heard so many great things about it.
Yeah, it is. You always run the risk of having a movie hyped up a little too much.
Of course.
And Prey, I won't say that Prey is a perfect film. Some of the animal CGI work is pretty dodgy, but... And also some of the ways that the animals behave doesn't make a lot of sense until you think about it in terms of the like this particular pulpy genre that
Fair.
This is in. But it is like such a well-crafted movie. Like it feels like after seeing so many movies which are done decently to indifferently, to see like all the small pieces that fit together and how nothing is wasted in Prey. Like if there's a scene, if there's an object, you know that object matters. Like it's one of those kind of films. For example, there's one scene, I'm not spoiling anything. The main character has her hands tied and she's trying to sort of, you know, cut the ropes. Starts with a wide shot and then goes into a close-up. But in the wide shot where a lot of things are happening, you can still see her trying to cut the ropes. Like, it's that level of basic care and attention paid to the filmmaking that really makes it a joy to watch.
Right. Also, it has Amber Midthunder, who was so great in Legion.
Oh, my God. She's so good.
I think we all, right? Like, we spent a bunch of Legion just going, like, she needs to do something bigger.
Yeah.
So it's fantastic to see that actually happen.
Yeah, she's great. I remember one reviewer basically... just had this, like, she has like silent cinema eyes. Like, they're just,
yeah.
Her eyes do so much work, and it's wonderful to see. The character, her brother, Tabe, played by first time actor Dakota Beavers, he is so good. Like, he's just so, like Mid Thunder, he's just so charismatic and such a presence. They
nice.
Just nailed it with the casting. And a lot of the, and one thing I like, because a lot of the work I've done with film and documentary over the years involves a lot of Indigenous people and First Nations people that I get very tired of seeing films with Indigenous representation where it's not very specific, or it feels like this pan-Indianism that mm-hmm. kind of blurs it. But like the Comanche stuff is Comanche stuff, you know. Like, for example,
well, and also,
they hunt, oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, also, you know, there is the Comanche dub.
Yeah.
Where they got all the actors to come back and do it that way, and you watch with subtitles, and I'm like, that's fascinating.
It was fascinating. I started watching the Comanche dub, and it's really cool. But the one problem that it's a dub, and I find it distracting. I always find dubs distracting. But I love the idea of it, and there's not a lot of dialogue in the movie, to be frank. A lot of it is communicated through visuals and action. You know, no, nobody says, "You're great, you're smart," you know, Amber Midthunder's character, Nehru. nobody has to say that. You understand how smart and resourceful the character is by the way she observes, learns, and uses what she's learned to, like, get to her goals. It is just nicely done character work. Anyway, the visuals are beautiful. People say, oh, this should be in theaters. But, yeah, this really would have been great in a theater. But we get it on Hulu, so that's nice. The other thing I did, I watched Le Sandman, L'Homme de Sand.
Okay.
And I'm kind of two minds about it. There are parts of it that I really enjoy, and parts of it where I'm like, is this a Verizon commercial for goths? Because that's kind of how some of it felt, or I don't know. Or it felt like slick commercial filmmaking and reliant on like that sort of film language when... Really, they could have, like, done something, I don't know, that it felt like sometimes it sort of cheapened some of the emotional moments. And it also has the main problem that the Sandman comic had, which is that the weakest stuff in the whole run of Sandman is the first few issues.
Yes.
And it's the same here. Like, it feels like a... It feels very much like a story. Like the first few episodes feel like fetch quest stuff, where he has to go, oh, I got to get my ruby, got to get my helm, got to get my pouch of sand. And wherever it hews too closely to that, it suffers because that's just not particularly interesting.
And they just kind of
dress it up with visuals, but the visuals are as impressive as they are. It's still a lot of people standing around in computer generated landscapes, which is kind of
right. I mean, and again, like, I'm not a huge fan of Sandman to begin with, but I will say that one of the weird things I've heard as a complaint, which I understand completely, mind you, is that by giving Dream eyes instead of just blacking them out,
mm-hmm.
it screws up how the character works.
It does, kind of, and I can understand why they didn't
sure.
do it. But at the same time, there's actually one scene in which, like, he's sort of in shadow, but his eyes are kind of like... glimmers of light. It's sort of like the opposite of usual, and I'm like, in that moment suddenly the Sandman, like Dream's character, just completely pops. It's like, that's, oh, that's god, and he's like horrifying, and then suddenly it's Tom Sturridge's face again, and he does a good job,
but
it's just like, it just, so he feels like a human being.
That's the issue. Yeah,
in costume, and Dream is not a human being. I also found interesting with Jenna Coleman's Constantine. I was wondering like how much it would be, whether they were going to do a gender swap John Constantine or do something else. And it is like, you get her when the character is introduced. She's in a nightmare, and it's all about Astra. Right, so it's that particular storyline with
right. No, it's completely that they decided to just make Joanna, because they also, like, because John has a small part, but Joanna had a bigger part in the past stuff.
Right. Yeah.
So why not just use the same actress and it doesn't matter?
Yeah. The funny thing, the really funny thing about this, and I think it's partly because it's impossible to nail Dream's character the way they're doing it, is that the show is best when he's not around or barely around, when it becomes stories about other people. So, for example, like there's that diner issue where, Dr. Destiny, or just as he's just John D. in this, traps people in a diner and basically makes them do what he likes. And, and Morpheus is barely in it. That works. A lot of the Doll's House stuff, which has like a bunch of sort of kooky characters, that actually kind of works as well. Because there's not a lot of Morpheus in it. So that's just a thing. And it's kind of part of the way the show is going to have to go. Although by the back half of the season, I actually was getting quite engrossed in it, and quite enjoyed it. Even like despite the fact that it has the issues that it has. Yeah. But yeah, the eyes are a big problem. And I found the whole Lucifer stuff. Gwendolyn Christie is great, but man, it's just so fucking overdone. I just couldn't take it seriously. And Patton Oswalt as Matthew the Raven. Jesus, the less of that, the better. I can see why they thought it would work. Right. Like on paper, that works, but goddamn, the way they do it, it does not work.
I get you.
I don't know. That's all I can say about that.
That's fair. Well, on that note.
On that note.
We should play some music. And like I said, come back next week with Debs and maybe some discussion of that weird period of time of film.
Yes.
Woo! Music.
Woo! Music.